prosecutorial misconduct and filed it in the Monroe County Circuit Court. The document alleged that Walter McMillan was unfairly tried, wrongly convicted, and illegally sentenced, and it drew a lot of attention in Monroeville. 3 years had passed since the trial. Most people assumed that Walter's guilt was a fact, and that all there was left to do was to wait for an execution date. Surprisingly, the Alabama Supreme Court agreed to stay or pause our direct appeal process so that we could go ahead with the Rule 32 petition. This signaled that the court saw there was something unusual about Walter's case that warranted further review in the lower courts. The Baldwin County Circuit Court judge was now obligated to review our case and could be forced to grant our discovery motions, which would require disclosure of all police and prosecutorial files. This was a very positive development. We needed to have another meeting with the DA, Tommy Chapman, and this time we'd be armed with a court order to turn over all files. We would also finally meet, in the flesh, the law enforcement officers involved in Walter's prosecution, the DA's investigator, Larry Eichner, ABI agent Simon Benson, and Sheriff Tom Tate. When we arrived at Chapman's office in the Monroe County Courthouse, the men were already there. Tate was a tall, heavy-set white man who had come to the meeting in boots, jeans, and a light shirt. Eichner was another white man in his mid-40s, wearing the same outfit. Neither of them smiled much. The men knew that we were accusing them of misconduct. "How much is Johnny D. paying y'all?" Tate asked, using Walter's nickname. "We work for a nonprofit. We don't charge the people we represent anything," I said as blandly and politely as I could. "Well, you're getting money from somewhere to do what you do." I decided to let that pass and move things forward. I thought that it might be a good idea to sign something that verifies these are all the files you all have on this case, I said after they handed over their files. I wanted to be certain they gave us everything. "We don't need to do anything that formal, Brian. These men are officers of the court, just like you and I. You should just take the files," Chapman said, apparently sensing that this suggestion had provoked Tate and Eichner. "Well, there could be files that have inadvertently been missed or documents that dropped out. I'm just trying to document that what we receive is what you give us. Same number of pages, same file folder headings, etc. I'm not questioning anyone's integrity." "The hell you ain't," Tate was direct. He looked at Chapman. "We can sign something confirming what we give him. I think we may need a record of that more than he does." Chapman nodded. We got the files and left Monroeville with a lot of excitement about what we might find in the hundreds of pages of records we'd received. Back in Montgomery, we eagerly started reviewing. The files were astonishing. We got records from Taylor Hardin, the mental health facility where Myers was sent after he first refused to testify. We got the ABI file from Simon Benson, the only black ABI agent in South Alabama, as he had proudly told us. We got Monroeville City Police Department records and other city files. We even got Escambia County records on the Vicki Pittman murder. Inspired by the elaborate conspiracies that Ralph Myers had described, we soon started asking questions about some of the law enforcement officers whose names kept coming up around the Pittman murder. We even decided to talk to the FBI about some of what we had learned. It wasn't long after that when the bomb threats started. Chapter 8. All God's Children. Uncried Tears. Imagine teardrops left uncried, from pain trapped inside, waiting to escape through the windows of your eyes. "Why won't you let us out?" the tears question the conscience. "Relinquish your fears and doubts, and heal yourself in the process." The conscience told the tears, "I know you really want me to cry, but if I release you from bondage and gaining your freedom, you die." The tears gave it some thought before giving the conscience an answer. "If crying brings you to triumph, then dying's not such a disaster." Ian E. Manuel, Union Correctional Institution. Trina Garnett was the youngest of 12 children living in the poorest section of Chester, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. Chester had extraordinarily high rates of poverty, crime, and unemployment, and the worst-ranked public school system among Pennsylvania's 501 districts. Nearly 46% of the city's children were living below the federal poverty level. Trina's father, Walter Garnett, was a former boxer whose failed career had turned him into a violent, abusive alcoholic. Trina's mother, Edith Garnett, was sickly after bearing so many children, some of whom were conceived during rapes by her husband. He would regularly punch, kick, and verbally abuse her in front of the children. When she lost consciousness during the beatings, he would shove a stick down her throat to revive her for more abuse. Nothing was safe in the Garnett home. Trina once watched her father strangle her pet dog into silence because it wouldn't stop barking. He beat the animal to death with a hammer and threw its limp body out a window. Trina had twin sisters, Lynn and Linda, who were a year older than she. They taught her to play invisible when she was a small child to shield her from their father when he was drunk and prowling their apartment with his belt to beat them. Trina was taught to hide under the bed or in a closet and remain as quiet as possible. Trina showed signs of intellectual disabilities and other troubles at a young age. When she was a toddler, she became seriously ill after ingesting lighter fluid when she was left unattended. At the age of 5, she accidentally set herself on fire, resulting in severe burns over her chest, stomach, and back. After weeks in the hospital, she was left terribly scarred. She was 9 years old when her mother died. Soon after that, Trina's father began sexually abusing her older sisters, and they fled. His abuse turned to Trina, Lynn, and Linda. The girls ran away from home and began roaming the streets of Chester. Trina and her sisters would eat out of garbage cans. Sometimes they would not eat for days. They slept in parks and public bathrooms. The girls stayed with their older sister Edie until Edie's husband began sexually abusing them. Their older siblings and aunts would sometimes provide temporary shelter, but the living situation would get disrupted by violence or death, and so Trina would find herself wandering the streets again. Her mother's death, the abuse, and the desperate circumstances all worsened Trina's emotional and mental health problems. She was sometimes so ill, her sisters got a relative to take her to the hospital. But she was penniless and was never allowed to stay long enough to become stable or recover. Late at night in August 1976, 14-year-old Trina and her friend 16-year-old Francis Newsom climbed through the window of a house to talk to the boys who lived there. The mother of these boys had forbidden her children to play with Trina, but Trina wanted to see them. Once she climbed into the dark house, she lit matches to find her way to the boys' room. The house caught fire. It spread quickly, and two boys who were sleeping in the home died from smoke asphyxiation. Their mother accused Trina of starting the fire intentionally, but Trina and her friend insisted that it was an accident. Trina was traumatized by the boys' deaths and could barely speak when the police arrested her. She was so non-functional and listless that her appointed lawyer thought she was incompetent to stand trial, but he failed to file the appropriate motions to support an incompetency determination, which would have pushed the trial back until Trina was well enough to defend herself. Her lawyer, who was later disbarred and jailed for criminal misconduct, also never challenged the state's decision to try Trina as an adult. As a result, Trina was forced to stand trial for second-degree murder in an adult courthouse. At trial, Francis Newsom testified against Trina in exchange for the charges against her being dropped. Trina was convicted of second-degree murder, and the trial moved to the sentencing phase. Pennsylvania's sentencing law was inflexible. The only sentence for those convicted of second-degree murder was mandatory life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Judge Reed, who presided over the case, expressed serious misgivings about the sentence he was forced to impose, given Trina's devastating life circumstances and the fact that she hadn't intended to harm anyone. "This is the saddest case I've ever seen," he wrote. For a tragic crime committed at 14, Trina was condemned to die in prison. At the age of 16, Trina walked through the gates of the state correctional institution at Muncie, an adult prison for women, terrified, still suffering from trauma and mental illness, and intensely vulnerable, with the knowledge that she would never leave. Prison spared Trina the uncertainty of homelessness, but presented new dangers and challenges. Not long after she arrived at Muncie, a male correctional officer pulled her into a secluded area and raped her. The crime was discovered when Trina became pregnant. As is often the case, the correctional officer was fired but not criminally prosecuted. Trina remained imprisoned and gave birth to a son while handcuffed to a bed. It wasn't until 2008 that most states abandoned the practice of shackling or handcuffing incarcerated women during delivery. Trina's baby boy was taken away from her and placed in foster care. She was devastated, and her mental health deteriorated further. Over the years, she became less functional and more mentally disabled. Her body began to spasm and quiver uncontrollably until she required a cane and then a wheelchair. By the time she turned 30, prison doctors diagnosed her with multiple sclerosis, intellectual disability, and mental illness related to trauma. In 2014, Trina turned 52. She has been in prison for 38 years. She is one of nearly 500 people in Pennsylvania who have been condemned to mandatory life imprisonment without parole for crimes they were accused of committing when they were between the ages of 13 and 17. It is the largest population of child offenders condemned to die in prison in any single jurisdiction in the world. In 1990, Ian Manuel and two older boys attempted to rob a couple who were out for dinner in Tampa, Florida. Ian was 13 years old. When Debbie Bagri resisted, Ian shot her with a handgun given to him by the older boys. The bullet went through Bagri's cheek, shattering several teeth and severely damaging her jaw. All three boys were arrested and charged with armed robbery and attempted homicide. Ian's appointed lawyer encouraged him to plead guilty, assuring him that he would be sentenced to no more than 15 years in prison. The lawyer didn't realize that two of the charges against Ian were punishable with sentences of life imprisonment without parole. The judge accepted Ian's plea and then sentenced him to life with no parole. Even though he was 13, the judge condemned Ian for living in the streets, for not having good parental supervision, and for his prior arrests for shoplifting and minor property crimes. Ian was sent to an adult prison, the Apalachee Correctional Institution, one of the toughest prisons in Florida. Juveniles housed in adult prisons are 5 times more likely to be the victims of sexual assault, so the staff at Apalachee put Ian, who was small for his age, in solitary confinement. Solitary confinement at Apalachee means living in a concrete box the size of a walk-in closet. You get your meals through a slot, you do not see other inmates, and you never touch or get near another human being. If you act out by talking back or refusing to follow an order, you are forced to sleep on the concrete floor without a mattress. If you shout or scream, your time in solitary is extended. If you hurt yourself by refusing to eat or mutilating your body, your time in solitary is extended. If you complain to officers or say anything menacing or inappropriate, your time in solitary is extended. You get 3 showers a week and are allowed 45 minutes in a small caged area for exercise a few times a week. Otherwise, you are alone, hidden away in your concrete box, week after week, month after month. In solitary, Ian became a self-described cutter. He would take anything sharp on his food tray to hurt himself. His mental health, unraveled, and he attempted suicide several times. Each time he hurt himself or acted out, his time in isolation was extended. Ian spent 18 years in uninterrupted solitary confinement. Once a month, Ian was allowed to make a phone call. Soon after he arrived in prison on Christmas Eve in 1992, he used his call to reach out to Debbie Bagri, the woman he shot. When she answered the phone, Ian spilled out an emotional apology, expressing his deep regret and remorse. Ms. Bagri was stunned to hear from the boy who had shot her, but she was moved by his call. She had physically recovered from the shooting and was working to become a successful bodybuilder and had started a magazine focused on women's health. That first surprising phone call led to a regular correspondence. Ian had been neglected by his family before the crime took place. He had been left to wander the streets with little parental or family support. In solitary, he met few prisoners or staff. As he sank deeper into despair, Debbie Bagri became one of the few people in Ian's life who encouraged him to remain strong. After communicating with Ian for several years, Bagri wrote the court and told the judge who sentenced Ian that his sentence was too harsh and that his conditions of confinement were inhumane. She tried to talk to prison officials and gave interviews to the press to draw attention to Ian's plight. "No one knows more than I do how destructive and reckless Ian's crime was. But what we're currently doing to him is mean and irresponsible," she told one reporter. "When this crime was committed, he was a child, a 13-year-old boy with a lot of problems, no supervision, and no help available. We are not children." The courts ignored Debbie Bagri's call for a reduced sentence. By 2010, Florida had sentenced more than 100 children to life imprisonment without parole for non-homicide offenses. All of the youngest condemned children, 13 or 14 years of age, were Black or Latino. Florida had the largest population in the world of children condemned to die in prison for non-homicides. The section of South Central Los Angeles where Antonio Nunez lived was plagued by gang violence. Antonio's mother would force her children to the floor when shooting erupted outside their crowded home. Numerous neighbors had been killed after being caught in the crossfire of gun violence. Antonio's home life was turbulent as well. From the time Antonio was in diapers, he endured beatings by his father, who hit him with his hand, fist, belt, and extension cords, causing bruises and cuts. He also witnessed terrifying conflicts in which his parents would violently assault and threaten to kill each other. Once he even called the police. He began experiencing severe nightmares from which he awoke screaming. Antonio's depressed mother neglected him. When he cried, she just left him alone. The only activity she could recall ever attending for Antonio was his graduation from a drug abuse resistance education, DARE program, in elementary school. In September 1999, a month after he turned 13, Antonio Nunez was riding his bicycle near his home when a stranger shot him in the stomach, side, and arm. Antonio collapsed onto the street. His 14-year-old brother Jose heard him screaming and ran to his aid. Jose was shot in the head and killed. Antonio suffered serious internal injuries that hospitalized him for weeks. His mother sent him to live with relatives in Las Vegas, where he tried to recover from the tragedy of his brother's death. Antonio was relieved to put the gangs and violence of South Central Los Angeles behind him. He was helpful at home and spent evenings doing his homework with help from his cousin's husband. But within a year, California probation authorities ordered him to return to Los Angeles. He was on probation for a prior minor offense. In poor urban neighborhoods across the United States, Black and brown boys are routinely targeted by the police. Even though many of these kids have done nothing wrong, they are stopped, presumed guilty, and suspected of being dangerous or engaged in criminal activity. The random stops, questioning, and harassment dramatically increase the risk of arrest for petty crimes. Many of these children develop criminal records for behavior that wealthier children engage in without consequences. forced back to South Central, Antonio struggled. A court later found that, living just blocks from where he was shot and his brother was killed, Nunez suffered trauma symptoms, including flashbacks, and an intensified need to protect himself from real or perceived threats. He got his hand on a gun for self-defense, but was quickly arrested for it and placed in a juvenile camp. His supervisors reported that he responded positively to the structured environment and guidance of staff members. After returning from the camp, 14-year-old Antonio was invited to a party where two men twice his age let him in on a strange plan. They were planning to fake a kidnapping to get money from a relative who would pay the ransom. They insisted that Antonio join them. The pretend victim sat in the back seat, while the man named Juan Perez drove and Antonio sat in the passenger seat. Before they arrived at their destination to retrieve the money, they found themselves being followed and then chased by two Latino men in a gray van. At some point, Perez and the other man gave Antonio a gun and told him to shoot at the van, and a dangerous high-speed shootout unfolded. The men chasing them were undercover police officers, but Antonio didn't know that when he fired. When a marked police car joined the pursuit, Antonio dropped the gun just before the car crashed into some trees. No one was injured, but Antonio and Perez were charged with aggravated kidnapping and attempted murder of the police officers. Antonio and his 27-year-old co-defendant were tried together in a joint trial. Both were found guilty. The Orange County judge sentenced Antonio to imprisonment until death, asserting that he was a dangerous gang member who could never change or be rehabilitated, despite his difficult background and the absence of any significant criminal history. The judge sent him to California's dangerous, overcrowded adult prisons. At 14, Antonio became the youngest person in the United States condemned to die in prison for a crime in which no one was physically injured. Most adults convicted of the kinds of crimes with which Trina, Ian, and Antonio were charged are not sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. So why were these teenagers? Juvenile justice systems vary across the United States, but most states would have kept Trina, Ian, or Antonio in juvenile custody until they turned 18 or 21. At most, they might have stayed in custody until age 25 or older. If their institutional history or juvenile detention record suggested that they were still a threat to public safety. In an earlier era, if you were 13 or 14 when you committed a crime, you would find yourself in the adult system with a lengthy sentence only if the crime was unusually high profile or committed by a black child against a white person in the South. For instance, in the infamous Scottsboro Boys case in the 1930s, two of the defendants, Roy Wright and Eugene Williams, were just 13 years old when they were wrongfully convicted of rape and sentenced to death in Alabama. By the late 1980s and early 1990s, the politics of fear and anger sweeping the country and fueling mass incarceration was turning its attention to children. Influential criminologists predicted a new generation of super predators, sometimes expressly focusing on black and brown children. Theorists suggested that America would soon be overcome by elementary school youngsters who pack guns instead of lunches and who have absolutely no respect for human life. Across the country, nearly every state created laws to allow children to be prosecuted as adults, thinking that the juvenile justice system wouldn't be harsh enough. Many states lowered or eliminated the minimum age for trying children as adults, leaving children as young as 8 vulnerable to adult prosecution and imprisonment. Tens of thousands of kids who had previously been managed by the juvenile justice system, with its well-developed protections and requirements for children, were now thrown into an increasingly overcrowded, violent, and desperate adult prison system. The predictions of super predators proved wildly inaccurate. The juvenile population in America increased from 1994 to 2000, but the juvenile crime rate declined, leading even the academics who had originally supported the superpredator theory to disclaim it. Of course, this admission came too late for kids like Trina, Ian, and Antonio. When I agreed to represent Trina, Ian, and Antonio years later, they had each been broken by years of hopelessness. Hidden away in adult prisons, they felt unknown and forgotten. With little family support or outside help, they each struggled to survive in dangerous, terrifying environments. There were thousands of children like them scattered throughout prisons in the United States, children who had been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole or other extreme sentences. Soon it became immediately clear that their extreme, unjust sentences were just one of the problems that had to be overcome. They were all damaged and traumatized by our system of justice. Trina's mental and physical health made life in prison extremely challenging. She was grateful for our help and showed remarkable improvement when we told her that we were going to fight to get her sentence reduced, but she had many other needs. She talked constantly about wanting to see her son. She wanted to know that she was not alone in the world. We tracked down her sisters and arranged a visit where Trina could see her son, and it seemed to strengthen her in ways I wouldn't have thought possible. I flew to California to meet Antonio at a maximum security prison dominated by aggressive guards, gangs, and frequent violence. It was an environment that corrupted healthy human development in every way. Reading had always been challenging for Antonio, but he was so determined to learn that he would read a passage over and over, looking up unfamiliar words in the dictionary we sent him. We sent him Darwin's The Origin of Species, which he hoped would help him better understand those around him. It turns out that Ian was very, very bright. Although being smart and sensitive made his extended time in solitary confinement especially destructive, he had managed to educate himself, read hundreds of books, and write poetry and short stories that reflected an impressive intellect. He sent me dozens of thoughtful letters and poems. We decided to publish a report to draw attention to the plight of children in the United States who had been sentenced to die in prison. I wanted to photograph some of our clients in order to give the life without parole sentences imposed on children a human face. Florida was one of the few states that would allow photographers inside a prison, so we asked prison officials if Ian could be permitted out of his solitary, no-touch existence for an hour so that the photographer we hired could take the pictures. To my delight, they agreed. As soon as the visit with the photographer was over, Ian immediately wrote me a letter. Dear Mr. Stevenson, I hope this letter reaches you in good health and everything is going well for you. The focal point of this letter is to thank you for the photo session with the photographer and obtain information from you how I can obtain a good amount of photos. As you know, I've been in solitary confinement approximately 14 and a half years. It's like the system has buried me alive, and I'm dead to the outside world. Those photos mean so very much to me right now. All I have is $1.75 in my inmate account right now. If I send you a dollar of that, how many of the photos will that purchase me? In my elation at the photo shoot today, I forgot to mention that today, June 19th, was my deceased mom's birthday. I know it's not a big significance, but reflecting on it afterward, it seems symbolic and special that the photo shoot took place on my mother's birthday. I don't know how to make you feel the emotion and importance of those photos, but to be real, I want to show the world I'm alive. I want to look at those photos and feel alive. It would really help with my pain. I felt joyful today during the photo shoot. I wanted it to never end. Every time you all visit and leave, I feel saddened, but I capture and cherish those moments in time, replaying them in my mind's eye, feeling grateful for human interaction and contact. But today, just the simple handshake we shared was a welcome addition to my sensory-deprived life. Please tell me how many photos I can get. I want those photos of myself, almost as bad as I want my freedom. Thank you for making a lot of the positive occurrences that are happening in my life possible. I don't know exactly how the law led you to me, but I thank God it did. I appreciate everything you and EJI are doing for me. Please, send me some photos, okay? Chapter 9. I'm Here. Finally, the date for Walter McMillan's hearing was nearing. Here was our opportunity to present all the new evidence in Walter's favor, including Ralph Meyer's testimony and the newly discovered police records. Meanwhile, Tom Chapman was preparing to defend Walter's conviction with the help of Assistant Attorney General Don Valeska, a longtime prosecutor with a reputation for being aggressive in his prosecution of bad guys. Michael and I had reached out to Chapman before the hearing to see if we could persuade him to reopen the investigation and independently re-examine whether Walter McMillan was guilty. But by now, Chapman and all of the law enforcement officers had grown tired of us. I had considered reporting to them the bomb threats and the death threats we'd received, since they were likely coming from people in Monroe County, but I wasn't sure anyone in the sheriff's or DA's office would care. Judge Robert E. Lee Key, Jr. had retired. The new judge on the case, Judge Thomas B. Norton, Jr., had also grown weary of us. We kept insisting on obtaining all files and evidence the state had in its possession. We were sure that there was still more that had not been turned over. In the last pretrial appearance, the judge had asked, "How much time will you need to present your evidence, Mr. Stevenson?" "We'd like to reserve a week, Your Honor." "A week? You've got to be joking. For a Rule 32 hearing? The trial in this case lasted only a day and a half." "Yes, sir. We believe this is an extraordinary case, and there are several witnesses and—" "3 days, Mr. Stevenson. If you can't make your case in 3 days after all this drama you've stirred up, you don't really have anything." "Judge, I adjourned." After spending another long day in Monroeville, tracking down a few final witnesses, Michael and I went back to the office to plan how to present all of the evidence in the narrow amount of time the judge had given us. Another concern was Meyer's trustworthiness. Ralph was such a wild card that we didn't know what to expect from him. We sat down with him a few days before the hearing to be crystal clear. "Just answer the questions accurately and honestly, Ralph," I warned him. "I always do," Ralph said confidently. "Wait, did you just say you always do?" Michael asked. "What are you talking about, you always do? Ralph, you lied through the entire trial. That's what we're going to expose at this hearing." "I know," Meyer said coolly. "I mean, I always tell y'all the truth." "Don't freak me out, Ralph. Just testify truthfully," Michael said. We arrived at the courthouse the morning of the hearing early and anxious. We were both dressed in dark suits, white shirts, and muted ties. I usually dressed as conservatively as possible for court. I was a young, bearded black man, and I tried to meet the court's expectation of what a lawyer looked like, if only for the sake of my clients. Both Myers and Walter were in holding cells in the basement of the courthouse. We first went to check on Myers. He was anxious. Worse, he was unusually quiet and reserved. I went to see Walter next. Being back at the courthouse where he'd been convicted 4 years earlier had shaken him, but he forced himself to smile when I walked in. "Was the trip okay?" I asked. "Everything is good, just hoping for something better than the last time I was here." I nodded sympathetically and reviewed with him what I thought would unfold over the next few days. Then I made my way upstairs to get ready for court to begin. When I entered the courtroom, I was shocked by what I saw. Dozens of people from the community, mostly black and poor, dressed in church clothes, had packed the viewing area. People from Walter's family, people who had attended the fish fry on the day of the crime, people we'd interviewed over the past several months, people who knew Walter from working with him, even Sam Crook and his posse, were crammed into the courtroom. Minnie and Armilla smiled as I walked in. Tom Chapman then walked in with Don Valeska, and they both scanned the room. I could tell from the looks on their faces they were unhappy about the crowd. Tate, Larry Eichner, and Benson, the law enforcement team primarily responsible for Walter's prosecution, entered behind them. The parents of Rhonda Morrison were seated at the front of the court. It took a few seconds for the black community members to settle into silence, which seemed to annoy Judge Norton, a balding white man in his 50s. But I was energized by their presence, and happy for Walter that so many people had come out to support him. "Gentlemen, are we ready to proceed?" Judge Norton asked. "We are, Your Honor," I replied. "But we intend to call several of the law enforcement officers present in the courtroom, and I would like to invoke the rule of sequestration." In criminal cases, witnesses who will be testifying are required to sit outside the courtroom so they can't alter their testimony based on what other witnesses say. Since officers were testifying, it seemed obvious that they should have to sit outside. Valeska was on his feet immediately. "No, Judge, that's not going to happen. These are the investigators who figured out this heinous crime, and we need them in court to present our case." I stayed on my feet. "The state doesn't bear the burden of presenting a case in these proceedings, Your Honor. We do. This isn't a criminal trial, but a post-conviction evidentiary hearing."
"Judge, they're the ones that are trying to retry this case, and we need our people inside," Valeska countered.
The judge jumped in with, "Well, it does sound like you're trying to retry the case, Mr. Stevenson, so I'm going to allow the state to keep the crime investigators in the courtroom." This was not a good start, but there was nothing we could do. I decided to proceed with an opening statement before calling Myers as our first witness. I wanted the judge to understand that we weren't just defending Mr. McMillan from a different angle than his old lawyers. I wanted him to know that we had dramatic new evidence of innocence that completely cleared Walter. I wanted him to know that justice demanded Walter's immediate release. "Your Honor, the state's case against Walter McMillan turned entirely on the testimony of Ralph Myers, who had several prior felony convictions and another capital murder case pending against him in Escambia County at the time of Mr. McMillan's trial. At trial, Mr. McMillan asserted that he is innocent and that he did not know Mr. Myers at the time of this crime. He has maintained his innocence throughout these proceedings." The judge had been fidgeting, and it seemed distracted when I started, so I paused. Even if he didn't agree, I wanted him to hear what I was saying. I stopped talking until I was sure that he was paying close attention. Finally, he made eye contact with me, so I continued. "There is no question that Walter McMillan was convicted of capital murder based on the testimony of Ralph Myers. There was no other evidence to establish Mr. McMillan's guilt for capital murder at trial other than Myers' testimony. The state had no physical evidence linking Mr. McMillan to this crime. The state had no motive. The state had no witnesses to the crime. The state had only the testimony of Ralph Myers. At trial, Myers testified that he was unknowingly and unwillingly made part of a capital murder and robbery on November 1, 1986, when Walter McMillan saw him at a car wash and asked him to drive Mr. McMillan's truck because his arm hurt. Myers stated that he drove Mr. McMillan to Jackson Cleaners, subsequently went into the cleaners, and saw Mr. McMillan with a gun, placing money in a brown bag. Another man who was white was also present in the cleaners. Myers testified this man had black-gray hair and allegedly talked to Mr. McMillan. Myers asserted that he was shoved and threatened by Mr. McMillan when he went into the cleaners. The mysterious third person, presumed to be in charge, allegedly instructed Mr. McMillan to get rid of Myers, which Mr. McMillan said he couldn't do because he was out of bullets. The white man in charge has never been identified or arrested by the state. The state has not been looking for a third person, a ringleader for this crime, because I think they recognize that this person doesn't exist." I paused again to let the meaning of this sink in. "Based on the testimony of Ralph Myers, Walter McMillan was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. As you're about to hear, the testimony of Ralph Myers was completely false. Again, Your Honor, the testimony of Ralph Myers at trial was completely false." I took a moment before turning to the bailiff to call Myers to the stand.
The courtroom was silent until the deputy opened the door, and Ralph Myers walked into the courtroom. Ralph had aged visibly since the last time the people in the courtroom had seen him. I could hear murmurs about how his hair had grayed. Dressed in his prison whites, Myers once again appeared small and sad to me as he climbed up onto the witness stand. Judge Norton was looking at him, attentively. I walked over to begin my examination. After asking him to state his name for the record and establishing that he had previously appeared in court and testified against Walter McMillan, it was time to get to the heart of things. I came closer to the witness stand. Mr. Myers, was the testimony you gave at Mr. McMillan's trial true? I was hoping that the judge couldn't see. I was holding my breath, waiting for Ralph to answer. Ralph looked at me coolly, but then spoke very clearly and confidently. Not at all. There was murmuring in the courtroom now, but the crowd quickly quieted to hear more. Not at all, I repeated before continuing. I wanted Ralph's recantation to sink in, but I didn't want to hesitate too long because we needed a lot more. Did you see Mr. McMillan on the day that Rhonda Morrison was murdered? Absolutely not. Ralph looked steady as he spoke. Did you drive his truck into Monroeville on that day? Absolutely not. Did you go into Jackson Cleaners when Rhonda Morrison was murdered? No, never did. Now, at Mr. McMillan's trial, did you give some testimony that there was a white man inside the cleaners when you went inside? Yes, I did. What was that testimony, please? As I can recall, the testimony was that I had overheard Walter McMillan saying something to this guy, and I also recalled saying that I had seen the back part of his head, but that's just about all I can recall on that. Was that testimony true, Mr. Myers? No, it wasn't. Now the judge leaned in to listen with rapt attention. Were any of the allegations you made against Walter McMillan as being involved in the Rhonda Morrison murder true? Ralph paused and looked around the courtroom before he answered. For the first time, there was emotion in his voice, regret or remorse. No. It seemed that everyone in the courtroom had been holding their breath, but now there was an audible buzz from many of Walter's supporters. I had a copy of the trial transcript and took Ralph through every sentence of his testimony against Walter. Statement by statement, he acknowledged that his previous testimony was entirely false. Myers would frequently turn his head to look Judge Norton directly in the eye as he spoke. Even during the lengthy cross-examination by Chapman, he remained firm. After relentless questioning about why he was changing his testimony, and Chapman's suggestion that someone was putting him up to this, Ralph became indignant. He looked at the prosecutor and said, "Me? I can simply look in your face, and anybody else's face, dead eye to eyeball, and tell you that that's all I, anything that was told about McMillan was a lie. As far as I know, McMillan didn't have anything to do with this, because on the day they say this happened, I didn't even see McMillan, and that's exactly what I told lots of people." I reviewed my notes and then glanced at Michael to make sure I hadn't forgotten anything. Are we okay? Michael looked astonished. Ralph was great. He was really, really great. I looked at Walter and only then realized that his eyes were moist. He was shaking his head from side to side in disbelief. I put my hand on his shoulder before announcing to the court that Myers could be excused. We had no further questions. Myers stood up to leave the courtroom. As the deputies led him to a side door, he looked apologetically at Walter before being escorted out. I'm not sure Walter saw him. People in the courtroom started whispering again. I heard one of Walter's relatives in a muted tone say, "Thank you, Jesus." The next challenge? To disprove the testimonies of Bill Hooks and Joe Hightower, who had claimed to see Walter's modified lowrider truck pulling out of the cleaners about the time Rhonda Morrison was murdered. I called Clay Cast to the stand. The white mechanic testified that Mr. McMillan's truck was not a lowrider in November 1986, when Rhonda Morrison was murdered. Cast had records and clearly remembered modifying Walter's truck in May 1987, over 6 months after the day when Hooks and Hightower claimed they'd seen a lowrider truck at the cleaners. We finished the day with Woodrow Eichner, a Monroeville police officer who testified that he was the first to arrive at the crime scene on the day of the murder. He asserted that the body of Rhonda Morrison was not by the front counter where Myers had testified it was. More significantly, Eichner testified that he had been asked by Pearson, the trial prosecutor, to testify that Morrison's body had been dragged through the store from the front counter to the spot where it was found. Eichner knew that such testimony would be false and had told the prosecutors that he refused to lie. He was soon after discharged from the police department. At this, the judge seemed visibly affected by the proceedings. I believe the concerned look on his face revealed confusion about what he was going to do in light of this evidence, and I considered the judge's newfound confusion and concern to be real progress. This was the first evidence that suggested that people in law enforcement had been so set on convicting Walter that they were ignoring, even hiding evidence that showed his innocence. All of the witnesses we called during the first day were white, and none had any loyalties to Walter McMillan. It seemed that Judge Norton had not expected that. The worry lines on his face were deepening. Maybe we were making some progress with him. When Woodrow Eichner's testimony ended, it was already deep into the afternoon. The judge looked at the clock and called it a day. I wanted to keep going, to continue until midnight if necessary, but I realized that that wasn't going to happen. I walked over to Walter. "We have to stop now?" he asked worriedly. "Yes, but we'll just pick up and keep going tomorrow morning." I smiled at him, and I was pleased when he smiled back. Walter looked at me excitedly. "Man, I can't tell you how I'm feeling right now. All this time I've been waiting for the truth and been hearing nothing but lies. Right now, feels incredible. I just..." A middle-aged white officer interrupted us to take Walter back to his holding cell. I told Walter I'd come down later. As people filed out of the courtroom, you could see hope growing among Walter's family. They came up to me and gave me hugs. Walter's sister, Armilla, his wife, Minnie, and his nephew, Giles, were all talking excitedly about the evidence we'd presented. Michael was pumped up, too. "Chapman should just call you and say he wants to drop the charges against Walter and let him go home." "Let's not hold our breath waiting for that call," I replied. I arrived at the courthouse early the next morning to visit Walter in his basement cell before the proceedings began. When I headed upstairs, I was confused to see a throng of black folks waiting in the courthouse lobby. I went up to Armilla, who looked at me with concern. "What's wrong?" I asked. "Why aren't y'all inside the courtroom?" If there had been a huge crowd yesterday, today's hearing had brought more people, including several clergy members and older people of color I'd never seen before. "They won't let us in, Mr. Stevenson." "What do you mean they won't let you in?" "We tried to go in earlier, and they told us we couldn't come in." What was going on? I pushed by the deputy, opened the door, and saw that the entire courtroom had been altered. Inside the courtroom door, they had placed a large metal detector, on the other side of which was an enormous German Shepherd, held back by a police officer. The courtroom was already half-filled. The benches that had been filled by Walter's supporters the previous day were now mostly occupied by older white people supporting the Morrisons and the prosecution. Clearly, Chapman and Valeska were trying to keep out Walter's supporters. They were already sitting at the prosecutor's table, acting as if nothing was going on. I was livid. I went directly to the judge's chambers to explain to Judge Norton that Walter McMillan's family and supporters had been denied entry into the courtroom. He rolled his eyes. "Mr. Stevenson, your people will just have to get here earlier," he said dismissively. "Judge, the problem isn't that they weren't here early. The problem is they were told they couldn't come into the courtroom." "No one is being denied entrance to the courtroom, Mr. Stevenson." He turned to his bailiff, who left the room. I followed the bailiff and saw him whisper something to the deputy outside the courtroom. Mr. McMillan's supporters would be led into the courtroom, now that it was already half-filled. "I'm sorry, everyone," I explained to the group. They've done something really inappropriate today. They'll let you in now, but the courtroom is already half filled with people here to support the state. There won't be enough seats for everyone. There were two ministers in the group. One of them, a heavy-set African-American man dressed in a dark suit with a large cross around his neck, walked over to me. "Mr. Stevenson, it's okay. Please don't worry about us. We'll have a few people be our representatives today, and we will be here even earlier tomorrow. We won't let nobody turn us around, sir." Minnie, Armilla, Walter's children, and several others went in. When the ministers called out, "Mrs. Williams," everyone seemed to smile. Mrs. Williams, an older black woman, stood up and prepared herself to enter the courtroom. She precisely adjusted the placement of her small hat and delicately wrapped a long blue scarf around her neck. I was thrilled to see all of Mr. McMillan's supporters, but realized that I needed to go inside myself. I hadn't spent the morning preparing for witnesses as I had intended, but had instead been drawn into this foolish mistreatment of Walter McMillan's supporters. I was standing at counsel's table when, out of the corner of my eye, I saw that Mrs. Williams had made it to the courtroom door. She wasn't a large woman, but there was something commanding about her presence. I couldn't help but watch her as she moved toward the metal detector. She walked more slowly than everyone else, but she held her head high with an undeniable grace and dignity. She reminded me of older women I'd been around all my life, women whose lives were hard, but who remained kind and dedicated themselves to building and sustaining their communities. Mrs. Williams glanced at the available rows to see where she would sit, and then turned to walk through the metal detector, and that's when she saw the dog. I watched all her composure fall away, replaced by a look of absolute fear. Her shoulders dropped, her body sagged, and she seemed paralyzed. For over a minute she stood there, frozen, and then her body began to tremble, and then shake noticeably. I heard her groan. Tears were running down her face, and she began to shake her head sadly. Then she turned around and hurried out of the courtroom. I was trying to shake off the dark feeling that the morning's events had conjured when the officers brought Walter into the courtroom. They allowed him to be in the courtroom without handcuffs, but had insisted on keeping his ankles shackled. Despite the state's early morning maneuvers and the bad omen of the dog and Mrs. Williams, we had another good day in court. State mental health workers who had treated Myers confirmed his testimony from the day before. Dr. Omar Mohabit explained that Myers had told him then that the police had framed him to accept the penalty for the murder case that he is accused of, or to testify that the man did. Mohabit reported that Myers also told him, "They told me to say what they wanted me to say." Evidence from three other doctors further confirmed this testimony, including a Dr. Bernard Bryant, who testified that Myers told him he did not commit the crime and that at the time he was incarcerated for the crime, he was threatened and harassed by the local police authorities into confessing he committed a crime. We emphasized to the court that all of these statements were made by Myers before the initial trial. Not only did these statements boost the credibility of Myers' recantation, but they had also been documented in medical records that, by law, should have been turned over to Walter's trial lawyers. The state's supporters and the victim's family seemed confused by the evidence we were presenting. It complicated the simple narrative they had embraced about Walter's guilt and the need for swift and harsh punishment. We had maintained a good pace, and the cross-examinations had been shorter than I had expected. By the end of that second day, I felt very hopeful. I was tired but feeling pleased as I walked to my car that evening. To my surprise, I noticed Mrs. Williams, the older woman from that morning, sitting outside the courthouse on a bench, alone. She stood when our eyes met. I walked over, remembering how unsettled I had been to see her flee from the courtroom earlier. "Mrs. Williams, I'm so sorry they did what they did this morning. They should not have done it, and I'm sorry if they upset you. But so you know, things went well today. I feel like we had a good day. Attorney Stevenson, I feel so bad. I feel so bad, she said and grabbed my hands. I should have come into that courtroom this morning. She began to weep. Mrs. Williams, it's all right, I said. They shouldn't have done what they did. Please don't worry about it. I put my arm around her and gave her a hug. No, 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 Attorney Stevenson. I was meant to be in that courtroom. I was supposed to be in that courtroom. It's okay, Mrs. Williams, it's okay. No, sir. I wanted to be there. I tried. Lord knows I tried, Mr. Stevenson, but when I saw that dog... She shook her head and stared away with a distant look. When I saw that dog, I thought about 1965, when we gathered at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma and tried to march for our voting rights. They beat us and put those dogs on us. She looked back at me sadly. I tried to move, Attorney Stevenson. I wanted to move, but I just couldn't do it. As she spoke, it seemed like a world of sadness surrounded her. She let go of my hand and walked away. I watched her get into a car with some other people I'd seen in the courtroom earlier. I drove back to the motel in a more somber mood to start preparing for the last day of hearings. The next morning was the third and final day of the hearing. The metal detector and the dog were still there, but no deputy stood at the door to block black people from entering. When I looked up at the courtroom door, there stood Mrs. Williams. She was once again dressed impeccably in her scarf and hat. I watched as the officers allowed her to move forward. She held her head up as she walked slowly through the metal detector, repeating over and over, "I ain't scared of no dog, I ain't scared of no dog." It was impossible to look away. She made it through the detector and stared at the dog. Then loud enough for everyone to hear, she belted out, "I ain't scared of no dog." She moved past the dog and walked into the courtroom. Black folks who were already inside beamed with joy as she passed them. She sat down near the front of the courtroom and turned to me with a broad smile and announced, "Attorney Stevenson, I'm here." "Mrs. Williams, it's so good to see you here. Thank you for coming." The courtroom filled up and I started getting my papers together. They brought Walter into the courtroom, the signal that the hearing was about to begin. That's when I heard Miss Williams call my name. "No, Attorney Stevenson, you didn't hear me. I said I'm here." She spoke very loudly, and I was a little confused and embarrassed. I turned around and smiled at her. "No, Mrs. Williams, I did hear you, and I'm so glad you're here." When I looked at her, though, it was as if she was in her own world. The courtroom was packed, and the bailiff brought the court to order as the judge walked in. Everyone rose, as is the custom. When the judge took the bench and sat down, everyone else in the courtroom sat down as well. There was an unusually long pause as we all waited for the judge to say something. I noticed people staring at something behind me, and that's when I turned around and saw that Mrs. Williams was still standing. The courtroom got very quiet. All eyes were on her. I tried to gesture to her that she should sit, but then she leaned her head back and shouted, "I'm here." People chuckled nervously as she took her seat. But when she looked at me, I saw tears in her eyes. In that moment, I felt something peculiar, a deep sense of recognition. I smiled now because I knew she was saying to the room, "I may be old, I may be poor, I may be black, but I'm here. I'm here because I've got this vision of justice that compels me to be a witness. I'm here because I'm supposed to be here. I'm here because you can't keep me away." I smiled at Mrs. Williams while she sat proudly. For the first time since I started working on the case, everything we were struggling to achieve finally seemed to make sense. It took me a moment to realize that the judge was calling my name, impatiently asking me to begin. The last day of hearings went well. 6 people who had been jailed or imprisoned with Ralph Myers testified that Ralph had told them he was being pressured to give false testimony against Walter McMillan. Their testimonials were consistent, and one explained that Myers had written letters saying he didn't even know Mr. McMillan. We saved the most powerful evidence for the end. the tapes of Thomas Tate, Simon Benson, and Larry Eichner interrogating Myers. On the tapes, Myers repeatedly told the police that he didn't know anything about the Morrison murder or Walter McMillan. The officers threatened Myers, and Myers